So yeah, the title of the talk is A Photonic Cluster State Machine Gun. This was research sponsored by Daniel James in order to help him deal with graduate students even more effectively than with the Beretta. Unfortunately, the paper was just recently accepted to PhysRev Letters, and they didn't approve of the title, and their suggested title was Proposal for Conversion of Single Photon Sources into Devices Which Can Emit Large Strings of Photonic Cluster States in a Controlled Pulsed on-demand manner. So we've had some arguments about that, but essentially that is what the outline of the talk is. So we'll go on to talking about just quantum computation. The standard circuit model of quantum computation, I'm sure, is familiar to all of you. We have systems, qubits, which... this is a laser pointer here. We have qubits which undergo unitary evolution. So when we draw a diagram like this, this direction means time. And at some final time, we do measurements on our qubits. So in terms of just Schrodinger evolution, I have some unitary, and I end up with some final state. Recently, for those of us that work in trying to build quantum computers and come up with ways of more efficient ways of using sort of different physical systems in a way, in some sense, that they want to be used, have been looking at a type of quantum computation called cluster state quantum computing, or one-way quantum computing. And in this version of quantum computing, when we have a diagram like this, this direction actually means space. These are actually qubits, and this direction also means space. So this here is actually a lattice of qubits, and these bonds here represent a particular way of preparing it. So this diagram is actually equivalent to a single quantum state. And in this method of quantum computing, what we do is we start by making measurements on this first column of qubits. And then based on the particular outcomes of the measurements that we get, we make measurements on the next column of qubits and the next one and so on. And so the trick for this method of quantum computing, which is equivalent to the circuit model, is really just preparing this initial state, this thing that we call a cluster state. Now, mathematically, it's easy to say, how do I sort of find that state in Hilbert space? The graphical representation you can interpret as being, well, start off with the qubits in the state 0 plus 1, the plus state, and then apply a particular unitary gate, in this case a controlled Z or a C phase gate, between the qubits. And that will give you the entangled state on which you only need to make single qubit measurements to do the computation. But for those of us that work with photonics and optical implementations of quantum information processing, this is not an easy thing to do. It's quite difficult to take in two photons which are in the plus state, say in a superposition of horizontal and vertical polarization, and find some nonlinear medium, maybe atoms in a cavity or so on, to interact them in such a way that you get out this two-qubit cluster state. This is a technically very challenging thing to do. But fortunately, in the last few years, we've realized that we don't necessarily have to do that. We learn a lesson from Neil Laflamme and Milburn, and we use interference and measurement to give us effective interaction. So we have a different way of building up cluster states. Basically, the most efficient way we know is you can start off with four single photons, send them through a particular interferometer like this, and if you detect two photons at these two detectors, then these two photons will be in a Bell pair, in a Bell state. And this Bell state is equivalent to a two-qubit cluster state. And so what we can then do is follow the same trick of just doing interference and measurement to start off with a bunch of these Bell pairs like this and then put them through interferometers. So we can put these two photons through an interferometer, and with probability 1/2, we'll manage to produce a larger piece of cluster state. But sometimes the gate fails, it's just a simple interferometer, and we get left with disconnected qubits. But in principle, we can iterate this process. We can now try and combine these two photons in an interferometer and make another larger piece of cluster state, and so on. The problem with this procedure, of course, is that it's still very resource intensive, but mainly that it requires lots of quantum memory. We're going to have to store these photons while we wait to put them through interferometers with other photons, and so on. And this is a technically challenging thing. Now, recently there's been some beautiful experiments done on producing Bell pairs directly in quantum dots by a bi-exciton cascade, it's called. And this would alleviate a lot of the problems with the initial step of taking four single photons and producing a Bell pair. But in practice, it's only going to alleviate that first step. We still then have to do lots of other things, right? And the other problem with those proposals is that they're quite sensitive to dephasing in the excitons, which is expected to be reasonably large. So the solution that I want to tell you about today, or a potential solution, is to design a source, and in particular, I'm going to be talking about quantum dots, and to use a source which typically people have imagined using to just produce single photons. But we're going to tweak the source a little bit in such a way that what it does is it fires out entangled photons. So this would be the first photon that it fired out, and then 10 nanoseconds later it might fire out this photon and so on. And so this actually gives us a much more efficient way of producing large pieces of cluster state. So to understand how this source works, you have to understand a little bit about the theorist version of how a quantum dot works. I'm actually sort of from an atomic physics background, so this is the sort of simplification that I have in mind. But in fact, these are very complicated structures to understand the physics deeply. But the sort of heuristic, the theorist version, looks something like this, that you have an energy level structure which is such that you can have a single electron. The quantum dot is kind of like an idealized atom in some sense. And this electron, when I pulse it with, in this case, right circularly polarized light, I can absorb one h-bar of angular momentum, and I create this thing called a negative trion. And this is a mixture of a hole and two electrons, the initial electron here and one other electron from within the quantum dot. And then when this thing decays, typically a few hundred picoseconds later, if we just look at the emission in the z direction, it decays to emit a right circularly polarized photon. So if I put in right circularly polarized light, I get out a right circularly polarized photon. And with quantum dots, these pulses can be, you can do it very rapidly because the energy levels are very well separated. Similarly, you could put in a left circularly polarized photon. If the electron started with spin down, it would then emit a left circularly polarized. If you put in a left circularly polarized pulse, you get out a left circularly polarized photon. Now, for those of us in atomic physics, we sort of wonder, where are the other energy levels? You would expect there to be some JZ plus or minus a half levels floating around here. And for reasons to do with band structure and so on, and things I don't completely understand, those energy levels in these solid state devices are quite far separated from these levels. So in practice, we only have to take these selection rules into account, which is quite different from what we might expect in atomic physics. Okay, so how might we use this to create entanglement, this set of quantum dot transitions? Well, one thing we could do is we could start with the electron in a superposition of up and down, and then we could do this pulse excitation, and we excite with a sort of a linear polarization that's exciting basically both with the right and the left polarization, so we get a superposition of trions up and down, as it were. And then when they decay, we get an entangled state between the electron in the quantum dot and the polarization of the photon. And then we could do this again. We could excite and emit again, and now we would get something like a GHZ state, up, right, right, plus down, left, left, and so on. The problem with this is that this type of GHZ entangled state is going to be very sensitive to decoherence of the electron in the quantum dot. And it's very difficult to kind of disentangle this electron sitting there in the quantum dot from the photons with which it's entangled, which are all downstream. So in principle, this type of entanglement, could be useful for quantum computing, but in practice, this is not a particularly useful cluster state, and it's very sensitive to decoherence. But let me just show you one a kind of circuit equivalent, so this will help you understand the actual machine gun that I want to talk about. An equivalent circuit for that whole process looks like this. I start with an electron in the state zero. I apply a Hadamard gate. That creates the superposition of up and down. And then I represent the production of photons by these controlled NOT gates. I start with qubits in the state zero. That's kind of like a photon in the state R for right circularly polarized. And then, depending on whether the electron spin is up or down, I create the photon to be right or left, as it were. And so that will be sort of mimicked in this circuit by the action of a controlled NOT gate. So the output state from this qubit circuit, it's just sort of a simple heuristic for understanding what goes on in this machine gun. The output state here would be a GHZ state, where this was the first emitted photon, the next one, and so on. So what's the trick to output instead of GHZ states, instead of creating this, instead of creating GHZ states where the electron is now sort of still entangled with the photons? What we want to create is linear cluster state, just strings of linear cluster. And it turns out all we need to do is add an in-plane static magnetic field that's a very weak field, weaker than the sorts of fields we heard Yelena talk about today. But what this weak field does is it just precesses the electron. We imagine it in the y direction, this in-plane field. And it basically just precesses between the up and the down electron states. And then what we do is easiest to see here is we say, imagine we do this precession to create the state up plus down. We do, and we excite a trion and then let it decay, so we again have the Bell pair. But now we wait until the spin is precessed another pion 2 angle in the Bloch sphere. So we now have a superposition. Up has gone to up plus down. Down has gone to up minus down, let's say. And now we do the excitation again. So now the up emits a right photon, the down emits a left, and so on. We now have an entangled state which is certainly not a GHZ state, and it's actually equivalent to linear cluster state. And this circuit kind of shows you the only difference is that we've now, on the previous circuit, we've added Hadamard gates in between each photon emission. But if you sit and write out what state does this quantum circuit have as its output, you find that it outputs linear cluster state. So what we were just imagining is you put the static magnetic field there, and then you just pulse in this linear polarized light and catch the electron which decays out every pion 2 rotations of the spin. So this is sort of the idealized version of how we can maybe turn something which people have typically thought of as a single photon source into something capable of producing multi-qubit entanglement. Now, of course, in practice, there's going to be a lot of things that give us noise in this system. So one of the things, we analyze many different noise processes, but the two most important things I'll tell you about. One of the most important noise sources is just to do, there's two ways of thinking about it. One is to do with the fact that because you still have this weak field, you get some spectral which path information when you do this decay. Another way of thinking of it is that the electron is continually precessing. So even though the decay is quite rapid, it precesses during the time at which the decay occurs. And this gives us some kind of imperfections in the output state. It doesn't come out as perfect linear cluster. In the sorts of things that we're interested in, we want that decay then to be really fast compared with the precession rate of the magnetic field. So that's going to be one of the sort of constraints that we have. The other type of decoherence that we're worried about is just the standard dephasing. So every spin has some kind of finite T2 time and finite relaxation time. And for this, there's many different experimental papers that have analyzed values for these things. And for quantum dots, typically what we might hope is to get decay times down to 100 picoseconds and T2 times on the order of a microsecond and T1 times. In fact, we generally neglect the T1 times with respect to T2 times. So the question that you might have is, does this type of decoherence, the standard dephasing, limit the state, limit us in the sense of the effectiveness of this cluster state, this optical cluster state? And fortunately, for this particular device, the errors that you incur on the electron spin can, just by sort of mathematically rewriting the quantum state, be turned into errors on the emitted photons. So it's kind of like the spin uses the photons as a scapegoat. Even though the spin is decohering, we can just mathematically imagine that instead the errors happened on the emitted photons. But what's really crucial is that an error on the spin only affects two of the emitted photons. So if we get a standard a dephasing error on the spin, we can just think of that as simple Pauli errors on two of the emitted photons. And we can use kind of standard fault tolerance proofs to say, well, you know, it's not going to affect the whole string of photons which come out, and so therefore we should be able to do efficient quantum computing. A simple way of seeing that in the circuit that I introduced before is something like this. Here was the ideal machine gun. If we imagine that there's a Pauli sigma y error on the electron spin here in the circuit, by just rewriting this circuit just mathematically, you can find that the error here is equivalent to two sigma z errors. Interestingly, it's equivalent to a sigma z error on the photon which is emitted just after the error happened on the spin, and a sigma z error on the photon emitted just before the error happened on the spin. So it's kind of like the error travels backwards in time onto one photon. But the important thing is that it only affects these two photons. So this becomes just a standard error model which we're very used to dealing with in quantum information theory. So this error localization is something which I'm hoping is useful in other contexts. In terms of the parameters of our machine gun, this here is a diagram which shows roughly the effect of increasing the strength of the magnetic field and with the sort of typical T2 times. So for the purposes of this talk, we can just worry about the bold lines here. These lines are just sort of different ways of dealing with some of the errors. But for the purposes of this talk, this is the sort of thing, the most basic thing to do. And what happens is that if the magnetic field is too fast, then this precession happens during the time that the photon is being emitted, during the time of the decay. And so you end up with regions which the error rate per photon. So this region here means that the error rate per photon is 1%. So if I pick values that I think are achievable, I think this sort of decay rate is probably achievable if you use a Purcell effect. I should emphasize that here we're not imagining that there's strong coupling between the electron and the cavity. We imagine there's a cavity there to direct the emission, and hopefully we get some kind of Purcell effect to increase the decay rate, but we don't need or even want strong coupling, so hopefully it's a bit simpler to do. But the sort of regime which we expect that, you know, an idealized quantum dot device might achieve at the moment is somewhere around here, so that the error rate per photon might be around 0.5%. And that would take us just almost to the limit of what the sort of the best results on fault-tolerant quantum computing with cluster states might achieve. So that's with sort of current devices, and we would basically have to improve things like the length of the T2 time, which hasn't been measured that precisely for these weak magnetic fields of, let's say, 20 millitesla, and we would have to improve potentially improve these decay rates. And then we could maybe get down really under some standard fault tolerant thresholds. But I should emphasize that, you know, having a source of this many entangled photons would allow us to do amazing things in quantum communication. And if you think of how many Nature papers have been based on just two entangled photons, I think there's a potential here for a semi-infinite number of Nature papers. What I haven't talked about is how we might create 2D cluster states. So I've talked about creating just 1D cluster state. Basically, if we do the following, if we excite after pion 2 rotation, so just after the electron has just gone halfway down the Bloch sphere, then we get linear cluster state like this. But if we excite sometimes by waiting until the photon has gone through a full pi rotation, then this becomes equivalent to sticking little legs out off the linear cluster state. And so if we do then another pion 2 and then two different pi rotations, and we're imagining these rotations are happening sort of every 10 nanoseconds or so, then we create something which is still topologically one-dimensional, but we have these nice little legs sticking off. And so what that lets us do is take two different pieces of this thing, imagine two parallel machine guns, and then we can stick these photons through the sort of fusion gates, the polarizing beam splitters that I mentioned before, in order to create some kind of non-trivial three-dimensional cluster state, and it's that which is universal for quantum computing. So that's the sort of big picture view on what we might do. There's technical problems because the photons which come out of the quantum dots tend to be slightly detuned from each other because the quantum dots are not identical, and so we have several ideas for how we might deal with that. But that's the sort of idealized picture of what one might do with these devices if you wanted to do full quantum computing. And the sort of overall architecture that I'm most interested in applying these ideas to is something like the following. We would imagine having a bank of these photonic machine guns. And so coming out here is this linear cluster. And then we can send these outputs through a fusion region, which is just a simple interference and non-deterministic combinations into a three-dimensional lattice. And the particular lattice that we're analyzing, so we're in the process of doing simulations to work out how fault-tolerant this whole game might be. But what we're really interested in doing is doing, Rausendorf has a beautiful version of topological quantum computing using measurement, using a particular type of 3D lattice and using measurement-based quantum computing, and it has very high thresholds on the order of a percent or so. So, and which the machine gun, in principle, can get under. So here would be a bunch of detectors doing these kind of braided measurements that Rausendorf has that give something equivalent to Kitaev's toric code and surface code protected quantum computation. So this is the sort of dream, of course. At the moment, I would just be very happy if someone tried to build just the very simple machine gun and tried to produce three or four entangled photons. I think that you know, it's potentially the way forward for optical quantum computing. So summary, well, basically single quantum dots can emit large strings of these entangled cluster states. In particular, this procedure, which I think is applicable to, for example, there's various cavity QED ideas for producing cluster states and so on, to examine this error localization, which I think is a very useful feature of the whole process. Importantly, the errors, even the T1 type errors, localize. And so in practice, you can fire this machine gun for much longer than the typical, even the T1 time of the quantum dot. Now the outlook, at the moment we're looking at a few things. One of the things we're interested in is it seems that you can grow these quantum dots on top of each other in kind of a linear geometry because they sort of grow in defects, as it were. You can get them side by side. And then there are some ideas for how to do very fast control Z gates between two adjacent quantum dots. And we've shown that this is kind of compatible with emitting cluster state. So we're looking at some scenarios where you do a fast optical gate between the two quantum dots and then you fire out a photon from each dot, and this will produce two-dimensional cluster state. But then there's a lot more complications once you start trying to couple two quantum dots, obviously. Something which I think is interesting to look at is, you know, we focus on quantum dots because these selection rules are so nice and it's a very simple system in terms of its energy level structure, but you know, there's plenty of other ideas for single photon sources, and what we've done is just sort of cook something which people had already imagined as a single photon source and turn it into something producing a lot of entanglement. So, you know, it would be worth looking at some of the other proposals for single photon sources. And the thing which I've spent most of the last few months thinking about is dealing with, I think the error rates I gave were very pessimistic because we took very pessimistic estimates of the errors because we were using kind of Markovian approximations. But really what happens in these solid state systems is you get a non-Markovian decoherence because the electron spin interacts with the nuclear spins. And so at the moment we've done some analysis which shows that in fact we should be able to deal with much lower error rates once we take into account these non-Markovian environments. I think that's kind of surprising because typically people imagine non-Markovian noise giving, you know, much more problems, and in fact here we should be able to bound the error rates to better than the sort of diagram I showed you. Anyway, here's the paper for anyone who's interested, and I'd love to talk with any quantum dot experimentalists because I'm trying to get a bigger picture view of like what is actually would prevent this experiment being done today. Thanks.